Well, thank you very much for the introduction, the great introduction, Asaf. Trying to sell those, push the books, not selling necessarily, but get some more visibility out of the book. Corona does really stop everything in its tracks, all sorts of plans for doing conferences and meeting everybody. So, in fact, I think the last time you and I met was not long before Corona in Israel at a
Exactly.
conference. So thank you for providing this the platform, or as you said, the floor is mine. I'm not sure that applies to these to a podcast. I
The
think
virtual
that
floor.
virtual floor, exactly, digital. We,
Exactly.
you and I had talked a little bit about how to frame this, and I came up with the concept of dysfunctional relationship, which I think is accurate in terms of describing Europe as a whole. Now, we could spend an hour or a day or weeks discussing what do we mean by Europe, but there are some very, on the case of dealing with Israel, for Western Europe, everything up to Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, but everything to the west of that, there's almost no difference between the official positions of the European countries. Occasionally, you get a nuance here and there, but they're all in it together, as the as are all the U official European Union spokespeople and diplomats and officials, repeating almost the same thing. And in that sense, they're talking right past Israelis, and I don't know whether the right term is that we're talking past the Europeans, or they're simply not listening. They have no interest in or capability to understand what we have to say. And I want to talk a little bit more about, to give some specific examples, and that we can go into to Q&A and discussions. I'll be mostly descriptive. I'll spend a little bit of time in the 15-minute intro towards the end talking about some of the reasons for it, and maybe some of the ways to try to push the Europeans out of being stuck in the same mold and repeating the same mantras, which go nowhere. And I start with that point about Europe as a whole. Again, I'm talking mainly about the 15 or so Western European countries, from Finland and Scandinavia in the north down to Spain and Italy, and to a lesser degree, Greece in the south, where you hear exactly the same positions and they're almost entirely unanimous. It's interesting that just the other day, when Serbia and Kosovo announced that they were opening up embassies in Jerusalem, and neither of them are members of the EU, but the EU condemned it and immediately came out, particularly against Serbia, for this terrible, dastardly act of agreeing to open up an embassy. It's against the European united position, the unanimous position. And that really does indicate that the way they approach all these issues. I was struck by the fact that when, because I spent a lot of time talking to European officials, again, I don't think they're listening, but we're talking and tweeting back and forth, and a correspondence, and I'll talk a little about the NGO aspect. But what struck me in watching, and we all watched the landing of the El Al flight in the UAE in Abu Dhabi last week. And there were three flags that they put on the plane as it came up to the ramp where everybody got off. There was an American flag, there was a UAE flag, and there was an Israeli flag. There was no European, it's not just a flag, there was a zero European presence in any of these activities. There was zero European activity involvement in this. And it kind of, as Alec, as Asaf said, I spent a number of years writing a very detailed book about the way that the Menachem Begin's documents and speeches and the whole Israeli archives shed light on the Egyptian-Israeli negotiations back in the 77 to 79. There was no European involvement in that at all. There was no European involvement in the Israeli-Jordanian peace agreement a few years after that. There's a lot of European talk and condemnations, and there's a lot of European money going into Palestinians and to NGOs, but there's, I found no contribution, and I haven't seen any response from any Europeans. So yeah, we've done something useful. They do provide a lot of money. Most of it goes to groups like UNRWA, which are counterproductive, money for helping the Palestinians for financial aid, but they don't, that's not translating into anything significant. And that's where I start this discussion. On the other hand, or perhaps in parallel to that, every conversation that you have with a European official, they try to guide it to the Palestinian issue. Again, going back to the case of the UAE or Egypt or relations with Jordan or issues having to do with Syria, and of course, talking a minute about Iran and the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement, the Europeans are primarily focused on the Palestinian issue. For them, Israel begins and ends, or their interaction with Israel begins and ends with the two-state solution, the mantras that they're pushing, and the issue of the Palestinians. They don't have, in almost all of their activities, and unfortunately I have to read all these European documents on that deal with Israel and the Middle East, which are almost always the same and extremely turgid, almost unreadable Eurospeak. Almost no recognition whatsoever of the region, of the issues that Israel confronts in the region. We have a parade, which we still have, of European diplomats. It's slowed down, but they come and go all the time. And they all spend a couple of days talking to Israelis. Then they go to Ramallah and talk to Abu Abbas and, Mahmoud Abbas and about the peace process. And that's really all that they do. And there is, as you all know, there is no peace process. There is still a European special envoy to the MEPP, the Middle East peace process. And the language tells you something. What is the Middle East peace process? So remember, we're talking about this tiny part of the whole Middle East, Israelis and Palestinians. That's their Middle East peace process, not Syria, not Iraq, not any other part of the region. It's so intensely, disproportionately, obsessively focused on we've got to bring peace to Israelis and Palestinians and nothing else is of interest. And as I said, without making any serious contributions. And that's part of the dissonance of dysfunctionality. I'll say a couple words briefly about Iran, because they are players in this. But again, here in a very contribution, is that such a word? They don't contribute anything. It was the JCPOA was primarily an agreement between Kerry and Zarif, that's what we saw in the pictures, between the Americans and the Iranian officials. Europe was there, as was Russia, and the five members of the Security Council, permanent, the other four members of the Security Council, Germany, were there for the pictures. Federica Mogherini, who was at that time the vice president in charge of foreign policy for the European Union, was there for the photo ops, but there was no substantive contribution. When the Trump administration, when President Trump decided that Iran was not living up to its obligations and that the agreement did not serve American interests, certainly not security interests, and broke it off, since then, the Europeans have tried to put Band-Aids on it to keep it together, entirely avoiding the substance of the issue, which is years of Iranian violations of their obligations and the clear evidence that Iran is seeking nuclear weapons. And you'll never see any kind of European discussion about that. Almost every week you'll get some sort of declaration from a European official. Borrell, who replaced Mogherini, the personality is different. The slogans are exactly the same about how we have to save the JCPOA. Now, Iran, according to the International Atomic Energy, has exceeded the limits on producing uranium by a factor of 10. And that doesn't enter at all into the European statements or European policies. So there as well, we have this complete disconnect. I want to spend a couple minutes talking about some of the reasons, then I'll talk a couple minutes about NGOs. They're at least officially Europeans, the EU and most members of the EU, plus Switzerland and Norway, they use these terms like soft power or normative power. On issues of, related to the Palestinians, they always talk about respect for international law and the structure of international relations built on international organizations, international law. These are mantras. So there is no interest whatsoever in Europeans in holding the Palestinians accountable in terms of norms. It's always the burdens on Israel. Israel is the powerful actor Again, we're talking about a map that begins at the Mediterranean and ends at the Jordan River. There's no Lebanon in this map. There's no Hezbollah on this European map. So there you are, in that mini map, that distorted map, Israel is the superpower. And the Palestinians are victims and suffering. And the normative power that Europe tries to bring to bear must all be done or brought to bear in order to support these Palestinians who are, they have no agency. They are unable to act for themselves. They need the help of the international community. They're all victims, and they have legitimate grievances, and it's up to Israel to meet those issues. And of course, with all the usual references to return to the pre-67, they call it borders, the armistice lines, UN resolutions, all of those things which have been repeated too many times to go through. To have a discussion with Europeans about the artificiality of all these, I go back to the term slogans and mantras, which have not changed at all since at least the Venice summit of 1980, when the EU first declared itself in favor of and said the way to solve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and that's how they look at it, is two states, is to establish a Palestinian state. So we've got 40 years, and you can go back early, you can go back to after 67 or 73, but it became official policy and mantra in 1980 at the Venice summit, and it hasn't departed one iota, even though there's been absolutely no progress and no indication that Palestinians are even interested in this. So this is a dialogue of the deaf, as I said, in terms of contributing to is one of the reasons that United States is able to have the influence that it has on Israel. And it was not a trivial point to convince the Israeli leadership, particularly Netanyahu, but the others, to drop the annexation or the declaration of extension of sovereignty in Israeli law to parts of the West Bank, something that was on the Israeli political agenda that was dropped in exchange for the UAE normalization agreement. Certainly affected by, engineered from Washington, the United States has a great deal of influence because it's Israel's only source of security. It's not just support in the United Nations and other areas, but the F-35s that we're talking about come from the United States, and they're essential to Israeli security, as are many other weapon systems. There's a lot of exchange of knowledge and of technology, and Israel is an important subcontractor and contributor. But the point is here, Europe has got none of those relationships. So of course they're shut out by Israelis. They have no leverage. One of the most disturbing aspects of European policy is this funding for a wide array of civil society or NGO non-governmental organizations. We estimate that together Europe provides on the order of 100 million euros a year. That's a lot of money. This is all of Europe together, again, from the Scandinavia, the north, down to Italy, including Italy and Spain, all of whom provide in excess of, I think in Spain, on the order of 4 million euros a year, Italy a little bit less. But together you add it up, 15, 20 from the EU, from Germany, and all of this money, all of it goes to a small group, mainly Palestinian and some Israeli organizations, that are repeating and reinforcing the European mantras. Human rights, international law, these are the organizations that go to the International Criminal Court. A list of 30 or 40, all these are available on the NGO Monitor website. This has been going on, not since Venice, but since the late 1990s, without any public discussion, without any evaluation. What are we actually accomplishing with this? That's all taxpayer money. It's taxpayer money, government-directed money, going to non-governmental organizations from the government, which is in itself an absurd and almost unheard of situation. The lack of evaluation of the damage that's done, the whole ICC process and bringing Israelis before the International Criminal Court, and we're waiting to see if the prosecutor goes to the next stage of opening up investigations. She's declared that she has jurisdiction, but now she's waiting for a three-judge panel to verify that she didn't make a mistake. That's all part of the sort of kabuki theater of the ICC, or the United Nations Human Rights Council blacklist, the embodiment of the BDS movement through a ridiculous list put together by the UN Human Rights Council, which is clearly a form of discrimination, and in many areas defined as a form of anti-Semitism, from the UN Human Rights Council. That was all driven by these same NGOs. Now, Europe, the European officials, and I speak to them quite often about this, and they have all sorts of excuses. But what the bottom line is, the same organizations get money every year. Clearly, there are close patron client relations. A number of the Palestinian organizations, I think we've identified about 10 so far, have high-level officials that are members of and have military ranks in a terrorist organization, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a number of whom now are on trial for having murdered Rena Schnerb about a year ago in Israel. And when you bring this up before Europeans, in most cases, you get statements like, well, the money doesn't go to terrorism, it goes to NGOs, and we have no information to verify that the money goes from there to the terrorists. But if you've got the top people in these organizations who are standing trial, in some places, some cases convicted, who openly declare themselves to be part of the PFLP, and I'm talking about funding that goes to the same organizations, again, in some cases, you have 10 different European government donors to the same groups. The Union of Agricultural Workers Committee. We've got, I think, on the order of 13, I don't remember the exact number, but on the order of at least 13 million euros over the last 2 years, going from a wide range of European countries. That's an organization which clearly has direct links and ties to the PFLP. And there are many other groups. I won't go through all of them now. And in some ways, that is the most emblematic aspect of European policies vis-a-vis Israel. Funding in secret. There's no public discussion. There are no protocols released how they pick their partners. It took them a number of years of being embarrassed that they didn't even publish who was getting funding, whereas the recipients all said, hey, we all get money from the EU, or we get money from Sweden, or from Denmark, or from Holland, or any other country. No public discussion. This is Europe's version of soft power. In secret, trying to manipulate Israeli politics by giving money to very narrow group of political NGOs, B'Tselem and Breaking the Silence and Musawa and Adala, a very narrow group of Israeli NGOs, and their musical chairs, the same people move from group to group, and to a similarly narrow group of Palestinian NGOs, many of whom partner with the Israeli NGOs in the same places we just discussed, the Human Rights Council. You'll see them huddling all together, writing joint letters, holding joint events. And that's a very, I would say, in some ways, nefarious, it's probably a better term, form of Europe influencing or trying to influence events in the region. They claim this is all in support of ending the occupation and the two-state solution. What it really does is it helps, maybe the term radicalizes is not appropriate for the Palestinians because they don't need extra radicalization, but it helps justify, it adds to the incitement. The language that's used, apartheid, racist, and often anti-Semitic terminology. All of this is documented. All of this has exact quotes. It's on social media. It's in some cartoon contests that they run. All of this is classified by the European governments to provide the money as supporting a two-state solution, as ending the occupation. Even if that were true, that would be anti-democratic, violation of sovereignty, an attempt to manipulate the internal affairs of a democratic country. Now, it's important in the same time to note that there is no European money whatsoever going to raise the issue among Palestinians, and I use this language carefully, of the right of return, what they call the right of return, or the myths of returning to 1948. I'm not going to spend any more time talking about Adi Schwartz and Einat Wolf's terrific book, The War of Return. they wrote an amazing book on that. But it's important to recognize that the Westplainers, it's like mansplaining, the Westplainers, those from the West who promote these kinds of Palestinian, the core Palestinian mythologies that are the fundamental obstacle to peace, get a huge amount of support and funding from European governments. I want to end on that point, or I will end on that point, and that is, so not only do you have the absence of any positive European role in its relationship with Israel or in terms of the conflict, but you also have this very negative impact helping to polarize Israeli society and to provide a lot of power to very marginal actors that work against any hope for reaching a compromise that will help to reduce and manage the conflict and even perhaps one day bring some modicum of peace. I'll end at that point. I've gone a little bit over time, but I think we still have a lot of things to talk about, and turn it over to you.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that really comprehensive analysis. You touched on a lot of issues and obviously raised a lot of questions. So the floor is now virtually open. And should you have a question, please raise your hand and I'll be able to unmute you. As I said before, and if you have questions, you want to write in through the chat, I'll read the questions. I see we have already a first question from my friend Jeffrey Cranes in Boston. Let me unmute Jeff. Jeff, can you hear us? Jeffrey, let's see if he's connected to audio. Jeffrey, can you hear us? Okay, we'll try again. Alex, do you want to start as I try to unmute here?
Yeah, I was just about to leap in, so let me thank you for your presentation. Let me just cut right to one issue that that you didn't really address, and that is why after 40 years of complete dysfunction and ineffective foreign policy, both individually as individual states and collectively in the context of the European Union and other organized venues, why do they keep doing this? Why don't they change in any way whatsoever? And what drives this this in the first place? This obsession, this monomania that is failed.
That the question is going to be much better than any answers I can give, but I'm going to try anyway. I've asked this question in different ways for a number of years in academic journal articles and in social media and in meetings. And I have I have some theories, right? We're scholars for peace, so we will use academic language. I think in part, the first layer is the immobility of the entire European foreign policy framework. It's worse than that phrase of turning an aircraft carrier. They are structurally and politically largely incapable of changing policies. First of all, in the framework of the EU, you've got 27 countries, and the British on this issue are still largely inside, although we've made some progress in getting them out of the NGO business. And to some degree, certainly under Boris Johnson, there have been somewhat different language been used, but not much. So you've got 27 plus countries, plus then you add to that Norway and Switzerland, who are indistinguishable in their policies from the rest of the EU. And there's nobody driving any kind of change. It's too difficult for them. Luxembourg, the foreign minister of Luxembourg is one of the outliers, one of the worst. And I'll get in a minute to some of the anti-Semitism that seems to be part of this process. And I can't give a 15-minute answer, so I'll just do headlines. But I start with the structural. They're incapable, and they don't have any kind of internal mechanisms by which to examine these kinds of questions of why have we failed. It's not only in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's in many other areas as well. But it is particularly pronounced. In fact, I would say that of all the issues, then I looked at them once a number of years ago and wrote about the structural aspects of this, that it's the, because it goes back so far, it goes back to at least 1980, the Venice Declaration in the 1980 framework was the first issue in which there was broad agreement among the, in those days, I don't remember what it was called, but there was the proto EU. And once they've agreed to that, they couldn't move away from that. Even changing a phrase in those declarations causes them infinite amount of being stuck in a bureaucratic maze, and that's part of it. So here we've got something that they all agree on, that it goes back 40 years, and it's the 40 years that it's so deeply encrusted that everybody, if they think about it at all, they would be afraid to open up that Pandora's box. I mentioned the point about anti-Semitism, and because that always comes up, and I think within Europe you see it in different forms in terms of their relationship with Israel. I do buy into the theory that the heritage, even though the churches are largely empty, the heritage of viewing Jewish self-determination is highly problematic. Churches, these empty churches, these progressive empty churches, which in each of these countries gets on the order of 100 million euros, even more in many places. In Germany, there are two or three such structures, which are the main international aid agencies for those governments. These churches are among the determinants of European policy. They both help to shape and manipulate and reinforce the anti-Israel narratives within their own countries, and they also help in terms of determining the way in which the foreign policy framework is made. They distribute aid, they come to the parliaments, they speak to the officials, they're on the ground and we see them all the time. And there's a deep layer of anti-Semitism there. So those are two of the factors that are involved. There are probably more that will come up. The lack of any real interest or understanding of Israeli security issues. They're so far into their, we are the future of the world, we solved all our problems by creating this peace framework, and we're now exporting it to the rest of the world. They just can't get away from that. And in that sense, like, so one could say they're full of their own advertising. And I see all this. I suggest to take a look at some of the statements of the Luxembourg foreign minister, because he's such an outlier. In the sense, he really does, and the decisions have to be made unanimously. His name is Jean Asselborn, and you see a combination of all these facts. He can freeze the structure. He's got a very deep-seated hostility towards Israel, which is expressed in progressive, liberal international law terms, but at least in my and other people's interpretation, has a layer of classical condescension leading to the anti-Semitism of Jewish statehood. There are more aspects, but I think we'll stop, leave it at that.
Great, thank you. All right, so there are a few questions. Let me read them. I'll start with no order of importance, but just to start getting some of the questions. So Sonia Bloomfield, one of our members, is asking, she's a cultural anthropologist, and she's wondering about the kinship ties between European government NGO members. Can you expand on that, Gerald?
I'm not sure that I can. I'll think about it for a second while I talk another aspect. In many of these Western European countries, there are also large Muslim populations, and I'm not sure this is kinship, but I recently read a doctoral dissertation by, of all people, a Swiss academic on the establishment in the European countries, in Germany in particular, of Palestinian support groups by Palestinians back in the 70s and 80s, or maybe even in the 60s. And I think, although we have not been able to trace that, if you go back that far from these groups, you begin to see the framework under which later on they become the channels by which the NGO funding takes place. It's very interesting. I won't be able to answer the question on kinship. I don't know very much. I haven't seen any evidence of that. There may be some. And because the processes are secret, we don't really know on what basis each country decides, or collectively how they decide to distribute. Again, we're talking about over 100 million euros a year. But what you do see is back, I said the money started to flow in the late 1990s. It was the Barcelona Conference in 1995 when Europe wanted to start to play a role counter to the US to bring peace to the region under the Oslo period. So they had this big conference in Barcelona where they threw a lot of money, billions of euros, which became the basis to a large degree also for the NGO funding. And right at the beginning, they already had these connections with the PFLP groups. You see that they had their favorites. Some of the people, you have the case of Shawan Jabarin, who is now and has been for many years the head of the El Haq organization, which is the principal group that goes to The Hague to present evidence, and I put that quote, even though we're just doing this audio, of Israeli war crimes to the International Criminal Court. In Hebrew, we say he's a ben bayit. He basically is a member of the family at the International Criminal Court. Shawan Jabarin is also a member of the family in many European countries, and he got a doctorate in international law in Ireland. And now we begin to see other people like that, Valentina Azarova, also from that same group. So there are certain hubs where these connections develop. Valentina Azarova has worked and continues to work for El Haq and a dozen other of these NGOs, so that are all closely connected. It's an interesting question. I'd love to see some research if we ever find out who the people are that are actually making those decisions and whether there is any kind of ties like that. Ideological, political ties, patron-client relationships for sure. Those definitely exist.
Great, thank you. My friend Jeffrey wasn't able to log on through the audio, but he sent in his question. And his question is, in your capacity at NGO Monitor, Gerald, are you following any of the EU purchases of lands in Area C as, I guess, a report by Regavim and those purchases with the Arab settlements, forming as far as an almost solid spine up and down the areas of Judea and Samaria? So what can you, if you want to expand on the issue of land purchases on those fronts?
There is a close relationship between the European effort to create facts on the ground by, I'm not sure the word purchase is appropriate, they build structures and support Palestinian claims by building school, what they call schools. One in particular, one aspect is they'll build large solar arrays. NGOs build the schools, NGOs build the solar arrays, which are de facto a means of taking over land. Now, there's no legal basis for these land takeovers. And that goes back to the discussion that was held in the Knesset and Regavim's aspects, all of which are in Area C. The European-funded NGOs are part of the means to those ends. So they'll give money to these various organizations that specialize in providing environmentally friendly solar arrays to Palestinians, and of course that means that and it just happens to be in strategic areas where the Palestinians are trying to again create facts on the ground. It makes it difficult when the Israeli security forces want to take down an illegal structure. It's a school. They, of course, bring in all the journalists to photograph this. How can you, these poor Palestinian victims, it gets back to that. You're depriving them of a school, you're depriving them of housing, you're depriving them of energy, of electricity. You're not providing them with electricity, so they have to get these solar arrays in its environment. And then Israel comes with its tractors and destroys them. And it all makes very good propaganda. And the NGOs are in the middle of this, a number of them. They're very much part of this. They help orchestrate the media process. It's a kind of indirect or hands-off approach. The Europeans say, we're not doing this. This is being done by the NGOs. I keep coming back to the school. There's a school in that's along the area of the highway that goes from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea, and then from there goes up it's called Route 90, goes up north and goes south along the Jordan River. And it's called Khan al-Ahmar. Khan al-Ahmar is a, it's become a big international focus. A Palestinian, old Bedouin, they didn't call it a city, but they call it a settlement or something like that. It's a bunch of tents, and there's a school in the middle, which was built by an Italian NGO, specifically as a provocation. There are very few, if any, actual children who live there. It's all political, and this is a classic case, and there are many others, of the use of European funding going to an NGO that uses language and claims to be doing great humanitarian work. And then when it is, builds a illegal structure like a school, there was also recently the claim that the IDF destroyed a corona testing clinic. It was a shack that was built to claim land, and they put up a sign on it saying this is corona testing. And of course, all the media ate it up. They don't ask questions. So yes, the NGOs play a central role in this process.
All right. That's, and again, very important to understand all of the political dynamics of all of this. And thank you for that.
It's a clever, I'll just add that the use of NGOs is a very clever European technique. It has all these combinations. It's soft power. It embodies international law and in respect for human rights. And of course, international aid, all these organizations have that language in their names and in their proclamations. When Europe grants Europe, any country or the EU provides them with funding, that language is always in the project description. They, of course, in almost every case, we can show that they're not actually using the money to promote any of those goals. But it's a very clever package, and it's worked for the Europeans in terms of promoting their agenda, even though it hasn't in any way had any positive impact.
Right, and all of us know, especially, you know, the three of us on this call, as far as, you know, not diminishing from our very you know, important audience, but, you know, it's the research that you have done, Gerald, and the work that Alex and I have done as far as UNRWA, the AFSC, as far as the facade of doing, you know, more the moral high ground, the justice, the charity that's involved. I mean, you know, people are willing to give it a pass by not actually diving into the politics of all of this, which is obviously especially pervasive in European circles, as well as in North America.
It's actually, yeah, in a lot of ways, it's stronger in Europe. When there's a democratic administration, then you see the same types of influence, but it's still somewhat arm's length. But in Europe, it's not arm's length at all. You have all these organizations that are part and parcel of the policymaking process. They are, as I said, they are members of the family, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in the parliaments or whether it's in the foreign ministries or whether it's through the media. It is a very deeply embedded part of the process.
Great. So I'm sure you know our friend Nunu Martins, who's in Europe right now. So he has a question. Let me see if I can unmute Nunu and see if he can ask his question. Oh, yeah. Nunu, can you hear us? Nunu?
I see Nunu's also on WhatsApp writing things.
Yeah, he's always, of course. Nunu, can you hear us? Nunu. Let's see. Nunu, can you hear us? You're unmuted. Okay, we'll have to get back to him. We'll move along.
Maybe, I see he's typing something, so, but not on this. This is on a different forum. Yeah.
Maybe you escaped, a question here or not. But let's we'll continue on. All right. So Charles Feynman is asking the question, jumping around Europe as we do, given the landscape. So he's wants a little bit more a deeper dive into the influence of Brexit on the UK's role within the NGOs, if you want to touch on that.
To a certain degree, Brexit, in terms of these specific issues, has allowed the government, and we're talking about a Tory government under Boris Johnson, to separate itself a bit from the standard European myths and doctrines I think it's probably a stronger term than that. And we do see that in some of the policies. They're less quick to join in with the usual condemnations back in the days. They did say, don't annex, don't do this, don't do that. But it was less obsessive. On terms of the NGOs, I'm going to be very cautiously optimistic. NGO funding goes in cycles. A year is the minimum, 2 or 3 years is generally, so that contracts to NGOs tend to be reviewed as the previous cycle ends. So haven't had that length of time under Boris Johnson to be able to see it definitively. But over the last 2 or 3 years, it began with Theresa May, throughout this last 5 years of Tory leadership, the funding for NGOs in the UK used to be one of the worst. And it is now significantly through their Department for International Development, through Christian Aid. When I first started doing NGO Monitor, the British NGOs were among the leaders. And of course, they were the first to get involved in the boycott movement, BDS movement, with the, as you probably all recall, with the AAUP. And the NGOs were there and were part of that, very much part of that, and funded by the British government. Most of that does not exist anymore. I'll say ended. In some ways, it's been redirected, but it's quite different. So the DFID, the Department for International Development, no longer funds some of the most ridiculous propaganda groups like Medical Aid for Palestinians, which does everything except provide medical aid to Palestinians, and a number of other groups they used to fund. The British Embassy in Tel Aviv stopped funding a number of years ago, breaking the silence, and B'Tselem and some of the Israeli groups. We don't see evidence that the British delegation to the Palestinians is a major supporter of the NGOs. So I'm going to say cautiously that it's significantly been reduced. The foreign ministry has also become much more involved. In many cases, the aid agencies that provide the funding for the NGOs are independent actors of the foreign ministries in their countries. They have a huge amount of money and power, and they just don't bother to even work closely with or to consult with the foreign ministry. In some cases, the foreign ministry says, fine, go ahead and give it to these groups. But in the case of the UK, things have changed. It's closer to the American model, where USAID was folded into the State Department and is monitored much more carefully, and they've become much more responsible. So while they're not at the place that USAID has been, and it began even for a few years before the Trump administration, but the British are, I think I can attribute that largely to the separation from the EU mantras and operations.
Great, thank you. So to tie into that, Gerald, Gerald Adler is asking, is there legislation, apropos the, what is seen on the Israeli side of things, is there any kind of Israeli legislation which requires NGOs operating in Israel to disclose their funding? And I'm adding to that question, maybe because, many of us are also here in North America, is there a parallel modality as it relates to FARA issues that we deal with here in the States, on the Israeli side, especially when it comes to the NGO factor that you deal with when you're looking at the funding?
This is too complicated an issue, and I've been involved in it too much to give a proper answer. I will say, if anybody wants to look at ngo-monitor.org at the website, and you want to type in FARA or legislation or Knesset, there's a much more detailed set of answers. So first of all, beginning, I believe it was in 2011, the Knesset adopted amendments to the existing legislation on terms of transparency and foreign government funding requirements. And that has been implemented. Sometimes we have to remind the designated agency that it has not followed up. But in most cases, we do, on the Israeli end, it doesn't work for the Palestinians. We have no mechanism for Palestinian reporting, obviously, of the vast amounts that they get. And they get more than the Israeli groups. So on the Israeli end, there is due diligence in terms of reporting. It's important because very often we'll find out about funding. I'll give you an example. A number of Israeli NGOs recently reported they were getting money, foreign money, from an organization called NGO Development Center, NDC, or PNDC, Palestinian NGO Development Center. And that's a weird framework. They have to report funding they get from any government framework. And there are significant penalties if they don't. We had thought the NDC had been closed down after a funding scandal back 5 or 6 years ago. And indeed, a number of the governments had pulled out. It turns out that they started to get money from the World Bank, something that was not known to the United States government, which is a major funder for the World Bank. And that's just one example of where transparency, the public right to know, plays a significant role. So in Israel, for Israeli NGOs receiving money from foreign governments, there is a reporting requirement. There are some elements of, and there have been a lot of discussions and legislation that's been introduced but never passed, that would also limit the ability of these organizations to act as foreign agents. And there was a big campaign that was mounted against using that kind of a language. I think very mistakenly and awkwardly, they wanted to have them wear different colored badges when they came to lobby in the Knesset, and that fell through. The legislation was withdrawn. But there is an awareness for the first time, I'd say, we've been working on this for 15 years. There is a somewhat of an awareness among legislators and among government officials, among some government offices, the foreign ministry, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, that this is a very unique means of trying to throw European weight around under all the labels that I talked about earlier. The problem is that when you have new people coming into office, you got to reintroduce all these issues. So very often people will condemn a particular NGO for doing something and will neglect to add. And by the way, that NGO, nobody would even care about it. It wouldn't be able to purchase all the media attention that they get in public relations if they weren't getting millions from European governments.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to try Nunu one more time. We'll see if that works for us. If not, let's see.
If not, then he'll contact me and we'll have our own discussion. But
I'm sure.
Hi, do you hear me now?
Yes, we're good. I was going to say, no. You're the expert. Fantastic. You spent so many years in Brussels. You know more about this than I do. So,
no, I'm still working in Brussels.
Okay.
So no, I have. In fact, I would like to. I think it's more of a comment than a question, because I disagree that it's the bureaucracy who creates these problems. I think the biggest problem is the change of narrative in the center-left political parties since the 1970s that basically created what we have now in Brussels against Israel. And the reason is also because the center-left parties basically have much more influence than the center-right. And somehow the center-right don't know how to impose their own policies. So I would like you to comment on this, because it's very important to understand this narrative of the Palestinians being the underdogs and somehow the EU blaming Israel for the unsuccess of the Middle East peace process.
As right. I said, Nuno, you know so much about this and you are on the ground. And that's an aspect which I completely agree that the political spectrum on the left in Europe is a big part of the problem. I think it does. I wouldn't remove the issue of the bureaucracy. You and I have both known, you probably better than I do, some of the people who sit in and make Middle Eastern policy and have been there forever in all sorts of different positions. And even when they leave, their successors do have the same myths, mantras, distortions. But I would also, I think that's also part of it. In terms of the political spectrum, though, what I find very often, and I'm asking you this question, is that even the more conservative parties tend to at least adopt, I'm not talking about the far right, But some of the other frameworks in Europe, and we see it in, we have not left-wing governments in general in a number of European countries, even in Germany. That's, to me, that's the best example, but I could also use it for France or elsewhere, where you do not have a left-wing government. In fact, you have a conservative government in Germany, and I don't know how to describe Macron, but they're not left-wing. They're not classical socialist, part of that whole Weltanschauung, if you want to use that term, that whole network. And yet their policies do not change at all. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's, it's that, to me, that suggests that it's more than the ideological and broader political perspectives on the power of Israel and the suffering of the Palestinians and the Palestinians as victims, all of that, that there's more to this process. Because this hasn't changed for 40 years, because it's the same from Finland down to Spain and Italy, I look for broader factors.
Look, I think to be honest with you, I think when you mention the bureaucracy, you are mentioning basically the civil servants. And the civil servants in the EU institutions are composed by people coming from the central left, the spectrum. And I can see that, for instance, in the European Parliament. It's unbelievable how the central left parties, the socialist group, can manage to put so many people. And just to give you an example, the president of the parliament is basically an agreement between the two biggest groups until the last election, when they had to include a third group, and they were alternating. So when Mr. Schulz, remember Martin Schulz when he was president of the parliament, he managed to have a two consecutive mandates. And when he left, the post should be taken by an EPP member, and it was taken eventually by Mr. Tajani. But still the socialists said, we refuse that, we are going to have our own candidate. And nobody said a word, because there was this idea, in my view, about the compromise, the political compromise, to put things forward. And somehow, also I don't know if this is true or not, but this is my guess, a kind of a guilt from the center-right and the conservative parties because of the historical facts and about the construction of the European Union as well and what happened before. But this is completely wrong, because this compromise at the end of the day, it is what is killing the European idea. First and second, there should not be any guilt from the conservative parties about what happened before the Second World War, because if you look, even in France, you had lots, and the majority of the parties, both on the right and on the left, made a compromise with, in the case of France, with the occupation, and in the case of Germany, with the Nazis. This is a fact. But still, there is this idea, and this idea, you can see it today in the institutions, and you can see it today in the social media, that nobody can say that Mr. Mussolini was in the beginning a socialist, this is a crime de lèse majesté, or that the Nazi party was known as a socialist party in the beginning of the beginning. Nobody said, you cannot say this. You cannot say this. And I haven't seen people being attacked because of this. So to go back to all of this.
No, it's going to be a longer conversation. And
it's a much bigger conversation.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm trying to stay on time. So, I mean, I know there's a lot to talk about, and I know you and Jerry will continue the conversation, but I just wanted to also keep us moving. So if I may, I'm going to apologize, but I'm
please
going to
do, and I apologize. Please do.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. All right. So Gerald, I'm just trying to keep an eye on the clock.
We're getting close to the end. Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting close. But let me just bring it back to Alex. Alex, as we're keeping an eye. Do you want to have? I'll give you the prerogative also of the last question before we wrap up for this afternoon.
Well, I think listening to all this, I'm struck as always with the impression from very much an American perspective of the anti-democratic nature of European politics at the what I call the imperial level, the EU, and also at the national level. So my question is, how does one go about influencing or shifting politics towards Israel, towards the Arab-Israeli conflict, Palestinian issue, on a systematic basis, as opposed to influencing things individually here and there, but more broadly across the board, when the bureaucracy has a broad consensus about the centrality of the issue, when national governments fund NGOs like the churches, which are obviously obsessed with the issue, and so on.
I hear your question, and I'm going to avoid it because
fair enough.
Precisely because I don't know that I don't have a way of shifting the big picture. My view is, and I've been doing it for 20 years, so maybe I claim to see successes that by chipping away at the small ones, undermining the superstructure. We don't have an influence on how the different parties worked out their policies, even in terms of the EU, on the choice of the commissioners, and Borrell, who certainly wouldn't have been anybody that I know is first choice for being in charge of, but neither was Mogherini or going back to Chris Patton. These are structural issues which one has to live with. On the other hand, and they bring their old worldviews, naming and shaming works quite well. Every European government that has funded NGOs in the last 3 or 4 years that are connected to the PFLP, that promote and produce anti-Semitic language, rhetoric, everything, videos, have been named and shamed successfully. I talked about 100 million euros. I'm talking about the NGO element, but I think it also applies to some degree. If there was more focus on this issue, it might also apply to Iran and the JCPOA. Naming and shaming where they are blatantly violating their own claim to moral principles. Each one of those countries, whenever I see a Norwegian official tweeting, and you can follow me and see me do this on Twitter, claiming their great moral positions, it's virtue signaling, raise the issue of not even saying a word about Iranian human rights violations. Not saying a word, of course, about Palestinian terrorism and all that whole range of things. We've had, over the last year or so, 2 years, full-page articles in mainstream media on some of the most blatant examples of failure to do due diligence on who they're funding, giving money to groups that are connected to terrorist organizations, giving money to groups that deal with anti-Semitism. That has an impact. There is an embarrassment factor because they claim to base their policies on morality, and because they're caught doing things which are completely counter to that morality, we chip away at it. Now, a new year, a new set of budgetary processes, a new politicians come in, and you got to start again, but you get better at it. There are a group of journalists out there who take that role or enjoy the fact that they're getting scoops. So last week in a mainstream Dutch newspaper, full page spread on that issue of funding NGOs that are connected to the PFLP, and had a big picture of the funeral of Rena Schnerb, and it brought people in. We got a lot of comments and embarrassed the government. And two ministers told Parliament in response to questions, they're looking into the allegations. Switzerland said, oh, we looked and we didn't find anything, so we're pushing it again. Depends where you have allies. If you've got people who can help name and shame in their own countries, it does make a difference. I don't have a better approach to these things from the point of from where I said. I think They are sensitive. They don't like academic articles in SBME. They don't like, because those last forever and they're quoted in dissertations and books and other places. They don't like to have this evidence out there as in a form of academic publications. Those things last forever. They come up in Google searches. They don't like to be associated with that. And I've seen that many times. So I am optimistic that by expanding this chipping away process, and I don't have anything better, one does begin to make some progress in the embarrassment field.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for everything, Gerald.
That's as optimistic as I get, folks.
Optimism is good. We need a little optimism in a very complex and a very dreary environment that we're all in. From the amount of questions, obviously there's a lot more we did not get to, and I apologize to everybody we did not get to today. If we did not get to your question, you could always reach us at bdsmonitor@sbme.org, and we'll be happy to forward the questions on to Gerald, and we'll be happy to answer those questions in a timely fashion. Gerald, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us and unpacking a very complex, layered, political, cultural challenge that we face in the NGO kind of sector, in the private and the public sector, that the interchangeable aspects that are playing out here that are all influencing a lot of the problems that we face as it relates to, of course, BDS and the anti-Israel animus that we find all over the place. So thank you for that. And obviously there's a lot to discuss, and I think I speak for all of us that we're stronger in numbers. So, all of us, continuing to be on the front line of these issues, which all of us have been, and of course you have for many years, Gerald, I think that we just got to continue the fight. So we're here to continue joining forces wherever we can.
All right. And that the SPME certainly carries a very important amount of weight in this. And in Europe as well, so it's a great combination. It's a good partnership.
Well, we appreciate the kind words, and wherever we can find synergies, we're always more than happy to. Alex, as always, I want to thank you for your comments and for helping me out here. And I want to thank, of course, everybody who participated this afternoon for taking the time to listen. We will continue these conversations next week. Our next speaker, just to plug, will be Ilan Carr, who will be addressing us next Wednesday. Look out for that notice that will be coming out in the next day or so. And again, keep your eyes up for all these, for the ongoing webinars. And of course, wherever you are, please stay safe and healthy. And we will talk soon. So have a good afternoon.
Okay, very good. Thank you all.
Thank you.